Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's September the 29th, 2017. I've been wondering quite a lot recently about a little assertion that the late Terence McKenna was often fond of uttering. And Terence used to say, "Culture is not your friend." And he offered an analysis of culture as being a part of the control apparatus of dominant groups in societies. And of course he's got a point, and this is a kind of straight post-Marx Marxist notion that's arisen out of the lacuna in Marx's work. Around the question of what exactly false consciousness was, or what exactly ideology was and how it worked and so forth. And this gave rise in the 20th century to Freudian Marxism and so on, and also to philosophical efforts like that of Slavoj Žižek to bring together Hegel and Lacan. Again, you know, Hegel is the source of Marx, or at least some aspect of Marx, particularly the notion of dialectic. And Lacan as being someone who took Freudianism forward, and particularly into an attempt to understand the relationship between the unconscious and language.
All right.
As you can probably hear from the few passers-by, this is a pretty multicultural place, and so there's a couple of Polish guys, I think they were, sounded like Polish to me, fishing in the canal, and then just some people walking the dog. You hear every kind of language here about, to be honest with you. In my yoga class, I've counted 23 nationalities coming through the door, and pretty well every major faith group has been represented. So, I mean, it's it's a question here about, you know, culture, the nature of culture, the value of culture. It sort of looms large. In the yoga world, there's a huge, noisy argument between those who think that there is cultural appropriation going on. And often these people are coming from a sort of Hindu supremacist point of view, or a Hindu nationalist point of view, claiming that it's been, that us white honkies have stolen it from them. I mean, I have problems with that because, for a start, yoga isn't culture. The yoga being state isn't culture. The yoga being state is kind of well in line with McKenna's utterance that culture is not your friend, in its attempts to find a transcultural vantage point. I mean, certainly the second verse in the Yoga Sutra, yoga is the cessation of whirlpools and the stuff of the mind. Well, whirlpools and the stuff of the mind are precisely our culturally determined conditionings. That is one aspect of what they are. And the way I'd put this poetically, where in the silent fire of deep meditation is your particularity? Where's your culture? Where's your gender? Where's your karma? Where's your past? Where's your future? None of it's there. And this state, of course, is highly valued. And if we understand yoga, the term yoga, as a meaning, not only the practices but also the being state, we can start to realise that, well, actually, yoga is not culture. Of course, it's been preserved by certain cultures. more or less. It gives rise to culture and cultural forms and art and modes of social organisation and all kinds of creative products emanate from the yoga being state. It's essentially creative. People who are touched by that being state become very creative as individuals. I use the term creative in the broadest sense. I mean, further on in the Yoga Sutra, when Patanjali is discussing Yama and Niyama, he described these ethical precepts, which is what they look like. I mean, I would argue that we need to be a bit more subtle about placing Yama and Niyama than that, but nevertheless, for the purposes of discussion, let's call them ethical commandments or precepts or something of that type. And when Patanjali discusses Yama and Niyama, particularly Yama, he tells us that these are universal vows, is how he describes them. And by universal, he means independent of the time and the place in which they're espoused or worked with, you might say, or practiced. Independent of time and place, Kala Desha. Doesn't matter what land you're in or what time you're in, they apply. And you can see there the impetus in Patanjali's culturally very spare discourse about yoga. An allegiance to something transcultural. So I think textually and actually and phenomenologically, yoga, the term yoga, if we understand it to mean the being state of a very profound samadhi, is not culture, is not itself culture. As I said, it can give rise to culture and its approach from a cultural context. As human beings, we cannot approach it except from a cultural context. Unless you're one of those rare beings who's just born into an easy samadhic state and manages to retain it all their life. Well, this is like one person in a trillion, probably. Most of us, even if we're gifted in this respect, we approach the yoga being state from the standpoint of culture. But yoga itself isn't culture. And so, there's something certainly in Patanjali's articulation of yoga which points in the direction of McKenna's distrust of culture, or seeing of culture as this kind of a malign operating system that is set up to dominate the majority of the population of any particular society. And as I said, McKenna is here in alignment with some 20th century work and 21st century work on people, by people, by philosophers who've taken a certain amount of Marx's work on board and have tried to address the lacuna in Marx. Culture is not your friend. And I say, I think he has a point. I think people are basically brainwashed. And even learning to speak a language is a kind of brainwashing. In some ways we have to be. We need some sort of minimal apparatus for functioning with others in societies. And human beings survive because they were able to act collectively in the early days of our species. That was the decisive factor. And language was a way of making this work. And similarly, at this juncture, where every single individual is nested in a network of dependencies and relationships, which you usually call culture. And I don't think McKenna's going to deny that. In fact, he was quite favourable to the rainforest cultures that were so formative of his outlook. So once again, this is one of those questions where we need to bring a bit of subtlety to bear. And what I say about culture is, yes, it very often aspects of culture form a part of the apparatus of dominance by one section of a society over another. This is usually understood as well as by our post-Marx Marxist, our Freudian Marxists like Marcuse and Reich, and Adorno, perhaps to some extent, and look, and Zizek, and just quite a lot of people have worked on this. But also, you see exactly this same insight worked through in a slightly different way by Nietzsche in On the Genealogy of Morals, which is in a sense a working through of the way cultural forms have a role to play in dominance within societies, but also the way in which they collide and transform as a result of that collision. Whereas, if you like, he gives us an outline of culture wars and wars for dominance between different cultures, as well as struggles to, by a few rare individuals, to perhaps see through this and to get a kind of yogic vantage point from outside of culture. But at the same time, we need some apparatus for communicating amongst ourselves. We need some means of preserving useful insights, methodologies, crafts from generation to generation, so that useful cultural forms can be preserved and maybe enhanced. Some of our useful discoveries have taken place because of this ability for generations to learn from previous generations through the preservation of good ideas through culture. At the same time, this is a methodology which has preserved some pretty horrible superstitions and some horrible practices like genital mutilation and so on. There is, in fact, a tension within this notion of cultural transmission, which we can call tradition, if you like. In as much as the job of a tradition is to preserve a good idea that's been useful, particularly in matters of survival for a community or a tribe or a culture, whilst at the same time there's a way in which these preservations, if they're allowed to be enhanced, mean that developments that can take place that couldn't be affected in a single human lifetime, they need the generations to accumulate and to build on. But the tension here is between the conservative nature of wanting to preserve what's good, which means that any development will be resisted, at the same time as the necessity and the great use of certain ideas that are going to take more than one human lifetime to develop. Now, science, I suppose, is this intergenerational conversation, and that scientists build on the developments and discoveries and explorations of previous generations. Isaac Newton himself said if he's been able to see a bit further than everybody else, it's because he stood on the shoulders of giants. And this is kind of right. This is science, isn't it? An intergenerational conversation that seeks to both preserve what is good, but also to build on what has gone before. So it's, at its best, it has a sort of respect for tradition, but a non-attachment to it, a willingness to allow even cherished ideas to be refuted if there is sufficient evidence and sufficient repetition of evidence. Philosophy, I suppose, is also a conversation across the generations, but it doesn't advance in quite the same way. Now, I do think there have been philosophical advancements, but they're tiny. In some senses, we're still asking the same questions that Plato asked. And somebody asked Wittgenstein, I think it was, yeah, why are we still asking the same questions 2,500 years later? And I think Wittgenstein just replied, well, we're in the same situation vis-a-vis language, vis-a-vis our organic being, and so on. So, you see, we can't completely damn culture. It's necessary. But at the same time, one sees Terence McKenna's point that it can lock us in into a very limited viewpoint. It can be a way in which we internalise our own oppression. And it can be a way of blinkering the senses so that we don't see the glory of the world and the sublimity of the world, including our own inner world, and we don't see just the infinity of it and the strangeness of it. Culture locks us out from the ineffable and the numinous. So you can see, as a man committed to exploring these realms, that he would have to say, culture is not your friend. So I get it, but I want us to be a bit more careful. And even though it's a formulation, I think we should throw at Hindu supremacists and also crass commodifiers of yoga and spiritualities in the cultural sense, taken from other geographies and places with other histories. It's crass, it's ugly, and of course it denatures as well. It actually robs the yoga and the meditation and the rainforest plant-induced ecstasy of its depth, of its possibility. The minute you turn it into a commodity, I would say, that you want to exploit and sell, that you immediately denature the things. There's nothing good to be got out of it once that's happened. But what's happening here is commodification. It's not cultural appropriation. The ayahuasca state is not culture. It's universal because it's simply an interaction between an ingested plant and the human organism, which produces experiences. It can happen anywhere at any time. And similarly, meditation attempts to guide us past culture. Now, there is a big question: is this actually possible? And this is a big question for 20th century philosophy, particularly post-Kant, where Kant posited the ultimate reality as being the noumenon, as being completely unknowable. We only ever know the phenomenon, the sense we make of the noumenon, with our limited sensory and cognitive apparatus. So there's been a kind of a struggle over the possibility of an unmediated experience. Because you have somebody like Derrida who'll say, there's nothing but the text. But we're locked in language, we're locked in the textuality of our linguistic understanding. And without our language, we don't understand anything. Understanding is a product of language. So he comes to the point, there's nothing but the text. Nothing but the text. Which is a bit like saying there is only the phenomenon. There might be a noumenon, but we can't say anything about it. But there is a claim. There's a claim by the yogis that there is this Olympian perspective, this transcultural perspective. Now, Erich Fromm, who was a Freudian Marxist, incidentally, took up the point and did posit a transcultural state, which was like a mystical awareness of being, as somehow a real possibility. And he's a guy who's Freudian Marxism led him to an interest in Rumi and Zen and so forth. Bear in mind the guy was a practicing analyst as well. So there's a big question there. I mean, is it actually possible? My view is, and it's based on experience, it is that there is a certain ecstasy available to us, actually rather more easily than people think, but which nevertheless is elusive rather than difficult, and that in that being state there really is, at least for a time, no culture, no ideas, no concepts. None of that stuff has got any meaning within this state. And even though one emerges as an individual human being, however enlightened, into the world of society and into the sea of culture, thereafter, once you've experienced this fire, you find yourself taking the stuff that people get very serious about and are quite willing to lay their lives down for with a very large pinch of salt. Yeah. And you see that, well, culture isn't their friend. And my view of culture is that culture really has got two jobs. One job is to help us to survive by preserving good ideas and allowing them to be enhanced through transgenerational transmission. On the one hand, so purely pragmatic. So now I need to get your knickers in a twist about that part of culture. And then there's the other part, which it strikes me originated from storytelling. And which was mythos, you might say. And this is when the myths were told by the Homeric poets or by the sages of the Mahabharata and so on. Purely for entertainment. Well, a certain amount of edification, a certain amount of showing human life, holding up a mirror to its tragedies and its comedies. A certain amount of edification, yeah, but mostly for the purposes of entertainment. But then, at some point, it was realised by some canny wallers that these stories, because people get very, very involved with them, very taken with them, these stories could be manipulated to get people to behave in certain ways, and certain ways that were useful to the manipulators. And so entertainment and storytelling became ideology, religion, collective myth that was capable of inducing those who heard the ideologies and the myths to go to war, to kill other people, to be deadly serious about it, to burn people at the stake, to stone people to death. And my utopian thought is, let's return culture to what it's meant to be, entertainment with some edification. And I say that because for myself, I don't want to be so yogic that I can't enjoy Game of Thrones. So, anyway, culture is not your friend. Okay, we get it, Terence. We get it, Terence. But let's just be a bit careful about that. And but he's right that we need to arrive at a place where we can take it all with a pinch of salt and be entertained by it. And have some fun creating it, rather than being beguiled by it to such an extent that we become dupes of dominant classes in society. And rather than allowing culture to become a tool of dominance and suppression. Well, thanks for listening, chaps.